Today, I don't have a lot by way of questions. I still have a few things in my folder for face-to-face questions. There's actually a bunch of emails in here. But I wanted to do the subject of... Where did I put that book? I had it sitting out here. Oh, here it is. I wanted to look at a book that... I actually haven't read the whole thing yet, but I've watched the DVD the book is based on. And I've read a lot of the book. It's called Evolution's Achilles' Heels. Evolution's Achilles' Heels. And this is a very significant book. And the DVD, the movie that goes with it, is very, very good. And I've watched that whole DVD numerous times. And what this book really does, it's very well organized. And it's got eight chapters in it. Addressing really the hard sciences that have developed a lot since the time of Darwin. And I think many people today who are Darwinists and who believe in evolution, and there are many, many, many people that do not actually realize that, as a matter of fact, many of the hard sciences and scientific disciplines at the time of Darwin were either real new or didn't exist at all yet. For example, genetics and DNA. Charles Darwin knew absolutely nothing about either one. DNA wasn't discovered until Francis Crick, much later, over 100 years later. And the science of genetics was just not even on the radar yet. In the mid-19th century when The Origin of Species was published. And what Darwin points out in his own work is that what he tries to say is the development of these hard sciences will bear out the idea that life originated on its own, accidentally, from matter, with no intelligence behind it of any kind whatsoever, and that life slowly but surely, through a slow, gradual process, the various forms of life and various trajectories of categories of life all developed from one common ancestor, a simple, self-replicating protein of some kind, or a so-called simple, single-celled organism. And the thing is, what we know today about a statement like that is the idea that there are simple forms of life is ludicrous. David Berlinsky from the Discovery Institute was asked the question. He's a very intelligent, high-powered intellectual. He's not a Christian, but he's a real critic of evolution. Berlinsky was asked the question in the DVD on this. If what we used to know about the cell at the time of Darwin, is a grain of sand. What, based on how much knowledge we've acquired of cell biology and how cells work today and what's going on inside of them, what would you compare it to? If knowledge at the time of Darwin was a grain of sand, what would our knowledge be today? And he said, a galaxy. Cells are the opposite of simple. They are so complicated that even the likes of Richard Dawkins himself has said that perhaps aliens seeded life on Earth. And that came out when Ben Stein interviewed him in the movie Expelled, where they document in that movie that if you even intonate that you believe in intelligent design, that life in this world has any intelligence behind it at all, you'll get blacklisted, lose your job, and everything else. And it's pretty, that documentary is pretty disturbing. But to me, the highlight of the DVD, Expelled, and I'm gonna get more into the book here in just a minute. I want to talk about some of these scientific things here, but the interview between Ben Stein and Richard Dawkins is pretty shocking to listen to. And I want to play a little bit of it here and let y'all hear it. Let me make sure the volume's turned up enough on here. Let's see if you can hear this. But some of the things he says are pretty surprising.
Hello, Professor Dawkins. How are you? I'm Ben Stein. I'm so sorry to keep you waiting. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
You have written that God is a psychotic delinquent invented by mad, deluded people.
No, I didn't say quite that. I said something rather better than that.
Oh, well, please tell us what you said. Please tell us what you said.
I would have to read it from the book.
No, please.
The God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction. Jealous and proud of it. A petty, unjust, unforgiving control freak.
Whoa! Unjust? Richard, if all we are is matter and motion, by what standard are you calling anything unjust? What is justice? And to say that something's unjust would imply that there's an absolute standard. Anyway.
Bloodthirsty ethnic cleanser. A misogynistic, homophobic, racist, infanticidal, genocidal, filicidal, pestilential, megalomaniacal, sadomasochistic, capriciously malevolent bully.
So that's what you think of God?
Yeah.
How about if people believed in a God of infinite lovingness and kindness and forgiveness and generosity, sort of like the modern day God? Why spoil it for them? Why not just let them have their fun and enjoy it?
I mean, I don't want to spoil anything for anybody. I write a book, people can read it if they want to.
Because it makes them lots of money. Just say it, Richard. Because I've made a mint attacking religion, because there is a cottage industry for doing so. Okay? People make megabucks writing dumb books against Christianity, like Jesus Interrupted by Bart Ehrman, where he points out these new discoveries called textual variants in the Bible. Really? We didn't even know that there were textual... I've known about textual variants since my parents got me my NIV study Bible. I actually read the introduction and read the little footnotes, and I know what NU stands for. It omits this and omits that. That stands for the Nestle-Aland 27th edition Greek New Testament, the United Bible Society's 4th edition Greek New Testament, and the textual variants between that and the so-called Textus Receptus, or the Byzantine text. And there are variants here and there. Big deal. Okay, Bart Ehrman writes about them like they're brand new discoveries, because people are so ignorant of the Bible and how we got it and everything else. But anyway, why, Ben Stein says, Richard, why don't you just let people have their fun? Why do you want to spoil it for him? Because he's made himself millions of dollars doing it. That's why. Plus, he can't help it. Richard Dawkins cannot help but be exactly what God's word says he is. And that is someone who is not just, you know, indifferent or neutral, but positively hostile to the idea of God's existence. And he hates God with every fiber of his soul.
I believe that it is a liberating thing to free yourself from primitive superstition.
So religions are primitive.
I think atheism is a primitive superstition. I think atheism is a positively destructive, enslaving primitive superstition. And that it's liberating to serve, know, and walk with the one true and living God. You're free to obey him and to be blessed and happy in this world. Happiness is actually possible in this world if you delight yourself in the law of the Lord and meditate in it day and night and don't listen to the counsel of the ungodly. It's an amazing thing. People who are the most enslaved to sin and to falsehood and to idolatry proclaim their liberty. It's pretty remarkable. It's exactly the opposite. Jesus came to set people free from that very kind of thinking. There's nothing liberating about, quote-unquote, getting rid of the God concept. There's everything enslaving about giving yourself over to the degrading passions in your heart and mind and body and doing your best to suppress any sense of conscience about anything that you do.
I think it is, yes.
So you believe it's liberating to tell people that there is no God?
I think a lot of people, when they give up God, feel a great sense of release. And freedom.
Why do you think that?
Of course they feel a sense of release and freedom. Because if they are successful in suppressing the knowledge of God, which is there, which does get through, according to Romans 1, and through creation, the more they can suppress it, the more they're free to pursue their own political, erotic, sexual, materialistic, whatever they're into, whatever they want to do to try to bring pleasure to themselves, pursuits, without any hindrance to it by pangs of conscience, thinking that you might be accountable to someone for the things that you do.
I mean, what's your scientist, what's your dad?
I've had a lot of letters saying that, and I've...
There are 8 billion people in the world, Dr. Dawkins. How many letters have you had?
No, I haven't done that. That's quite true.
Professor Dawkins seemed so convinced that God doesn't exist that I wondered if he would be willing to put a number on it.
Well, it's hard to put a figure on it, but I mean, I put it as something like, you know, 99% against or something.
Well, how do you know it's 99% against, say, and not 97?
No, I did. You asked me to put a figure on it, and I'm not comfortable putting a figure on it. I think it's... I just think it's very unlikely.
What?
It's very unlikely, he thinks, that God exists. It's pretty remarkable. It's pretty unlikely, he thinks. It's 99% unlikely. Anyway, there's a lot that could be said about that.
But you couldn't put a number on it?
No, of course not.
So it could
would
be 49%.
Well, it would be... I mean, I think it's unlikely, but it's quite far from 50%.
How do you know?
I don't know. I mean, I
mean, you got to catch that. How do you know that? I don't know. The way that he argues in his stuff, and I've read stuff by Richard Dawkins, he doesn't sound uncertain in his books. He sounds pretty... I mean, the book, his best-selling book is The God Delusion. Well, I don't know. I mean, he just said, I don't know. It gets even better, though. Stein just asks him some very simple, Socratic, basic questions. Listen to this.
Put an argument in the book.
Well, then who did create the heavens and the earth?
Why do you use the word who? You see, you immediately beg the question by using the word who.
You don't need to ask who. How did it get here? Why is all you got to ask is, why is there something instead of nothing? Where did it come from?
Well, then how did it get created?
Well, by a very slow process.
What? How did it...
Huh? Well, it got created by a very slow process. That's not actually what he's asking you. He didn't ask how long it took. He's asking you how it got here. Why does something exist instead of nothing?
Sorry.
Nobody knows how it got started. We know the kind of event that it must have been. We know the sort of event that must have happened for the origin of life.
An event for the origin of life.
What was that?
It was the origin of the first self-replicating molecule.
Right. How did that happen?
I told you, we don't know.
So you have no idea how it started?
No, nor has anybody.
Nor has anyone else. What do you think is the possibility that intelligent design might turn out to be the answer to some issues in genetics or in evolution?
Now, this really surprised me, because at the time this movie came out, I wasn't aware that he was willing to say things like this. So listen to what he says.
It could come about in the following way. It could be that at some earlier time, somewhere in the universe, a civilization...
What? A civilization, okay, of what? Of intelligent beings. Okay, now listen to how he kind of develops. I'll back up just a little bit here. Listen to how he develops this.
Genetics or in evolution.
It could come about in the following way. It could be that... at some earlier time, somewhere in the universe, a civilization evolved by probably some kind of devil.
Okay, he's asking you how it evolved here. I mean, why not go back and say, well, how did it evolve there? How did the first one start that then went out and supposedly seeded it in other places in the universe? You see, when pressed with the most basic, simple questions, these people stutter and stammer and have nothing to say.
Darwinian means to a very, very high level of technology and designed a form of life that they seeded onto perhaps this planet. Now, that is a possibility and an intriguing possibility.
See, at best, it's pure speculation. What evidence is there for that? What evidence is there that that happened? I mean, I suppose I could just say, Jesus stepped off of a UFO 2,000 years ago. Well, how do you know that, Patrick? Well, it's just an interesting hypothesis. It used to be the case that if you were a professor at Oxford or Cambridge or a university professor, that you had to have some kind of facts and some kind of argumentation to substantiate your claims or even what you speculated about. This is just pop metaphysics of the worst possible kind. Listen.
I suppose it's possible that you might find evidence for that if you look at the details of biochemistry, molecular biology. You might find a signature of some sort of designer.
What?
A signature of some kind of designer, like made by Joe Bob the alien or something? Is that what he means? Like a trademark? Like a Nike symbol? What on earth is he talking about? You see, if you're determined to live your life autonomously from God, you'll believe anything. It could be the most wild speculation for which there is no hard evidence or scientific reasoning behind whatsoever. And it's entertained as a real possibility as long as you maintain your anti-metaphysical bias, as long as you hold the line of philosophical naturalism and materialism, which as a worldview is completely absurd. Because it cannot account for the uniformity of nature. It cannot account for the validity of inductive reasoning. It cannot account for the law-like characteristics of the universe, of physics, chemistry, or mathematics that they will carry into the future. Only divine providence enables us to proceed believing that sort of thing. But I'm convinced Dawkins has never even considered anything like that, like his atheist counterparts 100 years ago did, because they were very, very bright.
Wait a second. Richard Dawkins thought intelligent design might be a legitimate pursuit?
And that designer could well be a higher intelligence from elsewhere in the universe. Well, but that higher intelligence would itself have had to have come about by some explicable, or ultimately explicable, process. It couldn't have just jumped into existence.
Yeah, he's just regimenting his thinking based on his naturalistic presuppositions. That intelligence could not be, you know, supernatural. It can't be God. It would have to be explicable by a naturalistic, materialistic process of some kind, even though the worldview that you're espousing cannot account for why things hold together into the future the way they always have in the past. You can't reason from the past to the future. Pardon me about that. And no one other than Bertrand Russell taught me that one, and so did David Hume. Men who are clearly hostile to Christianity and to the idea of God existing, but just continue listening here.
Spontaneously, that's the point.
So, Professor Dawkins was not against intelligent design.
Just certain types of designers.
Just certain types of designers, such as God.
God.
So the Hebrew God, the God of the Old Testament, he doesn't exist in your view.
Certainly. I mean, that would be a very unpleasant prospect.
That was a fascinating response. The God of the Hebrew God of the Old Testament doesn't exist. You would expect Dawkins to say, no, of course not. He kind of stuttered a little bit there, like, that would be a terrible, terrible prospect. Listen to how he answers that. That's just fascinating to me.
Against intelligent design, just certain types of design.
Now listen to this.
Such as God. So the Hebrew God, the God of the Old Testament, he doesn't exist in your view.
Certainly. I mean, that would be a very unpleasant prospect.
And the Holy Trinity of the New Testament.
Nothing like that.
Do you believe in any of the Hindu gods? Like Vishnu?
How can you ask such a question?
You don't,
how,
right?
How could I? I mean, why would I, given that I don't believe in any others?
You don't believe in the Muslim god?
No. And why do you even need to ask?
Well, I just wanted to be sure. So you don't believe in any god anywhere?
Any god anywhere would be completely incompatible with anything that I've said.
It would be completely incompatible with his untested, non-scientifically verified worldview of philosophical naturalism and materialism. And so what's amazing is that he's open to the idea of intelligent design. He's sharp enough to recognize that naturalistic processes really cannot account for the complexity of biology, biodiversity, biochemistry. The things that are able to be seen inside of individual cells using electron microscopes, he realizes that it defies logic and reason to say that that happened all by itself. So he's open to the idea of it being designed, just not by God. And so even his explanations for who may have designed it are completely controlled by, they're not influenced by, but controlled by, his philosophical worldview, which is naturalism and materialism, which is made very clear, and I don't believe in any god anywhere.
Make sure. You don't believe in any god anywhere.
No.
What if after you died, you ran into God? He said, what have you been doing, Richard? I mean, what have you been doing? I've been trying to be nice to you. Yeah. I gave you a multi-million-dollar paycheck over and over again with your book, and look what you did.
Bertrand Russell had that point put to him, and he said, something like, sir, Why did you take such pains to hide yourself?
Ugh. Why did you take such pains to hide yourself? I think that that's actually what God will say to Richard Dawkins. And that's what God would say to Bertrand Russell. Sir, why did you take such pains to hide yourself? God's existence is everywhere. You see it reflected in everything around you. And back to the subject of evolution, and obviously Dawkins is a proponent of evolution. I mean, what else could you promote if you are a naturalist materialist? In your philosophical worldview, your options are pretty limited there, since you don't believe in God or the supernatural. But I thought that was interesting that Dawkins, as Stein eloquently pointed out, Stein points out that he's not against intelligent design in principle. He just doesn't like certain types of intelligent designers. You see, now why is that? Why would Dawkins be okay with aliens from outer space? Something that there is no evidence of any kind that there's intelligent life anywhere in the universe, or that there's life anywhere other than Earth. Why would he be okay with that, but not okay with God? I can tell you exactly why. It's not just because of his worldview. It's also because if E.T. created us, if extraterrestrials created us, they're not going to judge us for how we live. And they can't save us or damn us after we die. God can. I think that's one of the reasons directed panspermia is actually the technical name of that theory, the idea that life was seeded here by aliens. People are okay with aliens doing it and not God, because aliens cannot judge us after we die for the life that we lived here. And aliens cannot read our thoughts and our hearts and minds the way God can. Okay, the book here, Evolution's Achilles' Heels. I want to strongly recommend it. And each chapter is written by a different PhD scientist, someone who is an expert in that field. Now, the first chapter is on natural selection. The second chapter is on genetics and DNA. The third chapter is on the origin of life. The fourth chapter is on the fossil record. The fifth chapter is the geologic record. The sixth, radiometric dating. Seven, cosmology. Where the universe came from, and then 8, ethics and morality. Now, I want to point out a couple things before I share some of the really interesting, useful things that are contained in the book. I was taught that evolution was a fact when I was in sixth grade science, and my parents, they did do a good job. They knew that this was coming, and they were aware that we were going to be taught this, and they prepared me a little bit. But I was, again and again, really thrown back at the complete lack of any kind of evidence. And I could see, even at the age of, how old are you in sixth grade? 11 or 12, 11 and 12 years old, that we really weren't given any evidence whatsoever. Mr. Flowers was the name of my sixth grade science teacher. And he actually was a very good teacher. I learned a lot about science from him. And in fact, I still remember, I mean, this is, I was 12 back then, so 34 years ago, 46 now, he taught us a lot about cells. And one of the things that we had to do in that class that was so interesting to me, my mom and I went to a local park where there was a pond, and we were told to take a mason jar and to fill the mason jar with water from the pond, and then take it down, you know, on the edge of the pond there, and get some of the crud right on the top of where the mud is at the bottom of the pond, just scrape some of that into the mason jar, and then put a lid on it and let it sit for a few days at school so all the junk would settle. And then what we would do is take an eyedropper and stick it down in there, right where you'd put the tip of the eyedropper right where the mud and the crud at the bottom that had settled there was, and you would suck up just a little bit of that. And then you would pinch that onto a Petri dish and put a little square piece of glass on it. And the school had bought these really nice, very powerful microscopes. And I really had no idea what we were going to see. I wasn't sure, like, what in the world are we going to look at in there? And he had told us, you know, they're going to see single-celled organisms, and we'd actually learned their names. I still remember the name. There were parameciums and vorticellae, and there were flagellums in there. Or am I getting the plural on that right? I don't remember. I was absolutely blown away. I still remember looking at those little things. And you could see the little hairs. Like, when you put the microscope up to the highest setting, you could see the tiny little hairs that surrounded the body of a paramecium. A paramecium is a single-celled organism. And the vorticellae had, they were like little bells. They looked like little bells that would twitch and stuff. And then the flagellum had like a little red eye on them. And it was a single cell. And it had a little rotor for a tail that it would use to swim around. And it was remarkable. I was just blown away by it because we learned about all the parts of a cell. We learned about the plasma membrane and the cell wall and the mitochondria and the nucleus and the DNA and the chromosomes and the how cells divided and things like that. One science class when I was a sophomore in high school, we had to take the tips of roots off of potatoes, and you take a teensy tiny little slice of that, put it on a piece of glass with stuff on it. And you could see the various stages of mitosis. And I remember looking at that going, that's just incredible. It's just amazing. Just unbelievable to watch these cells divide. And that's how those roots grow. They divide, and then those divide. And we were taught about how they made copies of the chromosomes and the DNA, and the watching them divide was just astounding to me. And then you'd have two separate cells with their own nucleus, and then those cells had the ability to divide, and just unbelievable. And Mr. Flowers taught us, I mean, he actually said, I remember specifically him saying in class, there is no God. And because there's no God, we have to explain what we see all around us. And we see a lot of biodiversity. We see all the plants and the flies and butterflies. And in our classroom there in sixth grade science, we had hamsters and guinea pigs and stuff. And but back then, school was a little more, it was interesting. We had to take care of pets in our own classrooms. And people would be in charge of like changing the hay and stuff. And so we looked at these animals that we kind of had as class pets, and we did all kinds of stuff like that. And we dissected stuff. We had to dissect a frog and a crayfish and all kinds of stuff. And learned a ton about cell biology and all the different parts inside a cell. I was blown away by it because you could see those parts under the microscope in those single-celled organisms. And Mr. Flowers taught us about human beings. He said man is also evolved from different trajectories of ape-like hominids. You know, they didn't look like gorillas do today. They you know, were different trajectories and things like that. So he really knew his stuff as far as the way the theory was. But I can honestly say, with no hesitation at all, there was never a moment that I believed it. Because we were given no evidence for it at all. I mean, they tried Archaeopteryx. Here's a dinosaur bird. And I remember even back then thinking, one? You have one thing that's supposedly on its way to becoming something else. And you look at the fossils and you look at the pictures of Archaeopteryx. I'm like, I remember even as a kid going, that's a bird. That's not a dinosaur bird hybrid or something like that. Archaeopteryx is a bird. Okay. And Lucy and Piltdown Man, there's a documentary on, I believe, I don't know if it's on Netflix or where it is. It's called History's Greatest Hoaxes. And there's an entire episode about Piltdown Man. Piltdown Man was a bald-faced lie. Okay, I have a book on my evolution shelf back there, Bones of Contention. And I have some lectures by scientists about all the different supposed ape-human fossil links, missing links. And they're lies, they're frauds. It's like someone found a pig tooth and they constructed an entire skeleton and try to make it look like it's somewhere between an ape-like creature and a modern human being. And the things that we were told and taught when I was in sixth grade science were left me just absolutely incredulous. I just was so surprised at the things that Mr. Flowers said. And I remember on a test, we actually had to write down this answer on a test. The first question on that science test was, where did life begin? And the answer that we had been taught to write in there was a little warm pond. Life began accidentally by itself, undirected, no intelligence whatsoever behind it at all, in a little warm pond. And supposedly, the piling on of genetic mutations, which are mistakes, eyes and ears and fingers and bones and skin and veins and arteries and cartilage and teeth and muscle cells and nose and brains and everything accidentally formed with no direction of any kind. Even when I was 11 and 12 years old, I remember even back then thinking, you ask too much of me to believe this. And there's no part of me that ever did. I didn't even think for a second that it might be true. That it might be true. We weren't shown any evidence of any kind that was the case. And to this day, I still have never seen any evidence at all for evolution. Evolution is a religion. It's a worldview. It's a philosophical pre-commitment to materialism and naturalism. And with that commitment firmly in place, with no scientific investigation to try to verify those presuppositions, that naturalist-materialist presupposition, okay, since there's no God, there's no supernatural realm whatsoever, all that exists is matter in motion, how do we explain everything around us? And it's, well, I guess it just happened by itself. Okay, let's talk about a few of these subjects here in the book. Natural selection. Natural selection is simply differential reproduction. The offspring of various forms of life, they share some of the attributes and some of the characteristics of their parents, but they'll be slightly different. And the idea is that, well, the fittest survive. That's actually not verifiable. Very often it's not the fittest that survive. But overall, you could maintain and argue that the ones that are the most fit or the strongest or whatever tend to be the ones that survive and go on. But natural selection is not a mechanism through which new information is added to genomes of living things. And in fact, there's a funny quotation on YouTube, Richard Dawkins being asked about, have any point mutations ever been discovered that add information to genomes? And there's not. And that's one of the things that they point out in the section on genetics in the book and in the DVD, is that genetic entropy, it's called, is that everything is losing information. And in fact, flightless cormorants are birds that are found in the Galapagos that have wings, but they can't fly. And probably at one time they were able to fly, but they don't fly anymore because they don't need to. The way that they live and what their diets, they don't need to. And people say, oh, see, that's evolution. No, it's not evolution. It's not evolution upwards. It's losing information that will be lost forever. And that's what happens with animals. The more they live, the more they reproduce, the more there are mistakes in their genetic code. And that's why we are the genetic messes that we are. That's why we have so many health problems and our eyes eventually don't work or they don't work at all when we come into the world. Our ears don't work and our bodies start to break down and ache and everything else. We inherit the genetic mistakes that are from our parents, and then we have some of our own, and then we give ours and everyone before us to our children. So we're not evolving upwards. We're not getting more complicated. We're not gaining new information. We're actually rusting out like a car. We're losing more and more and more information. And the thing is, once those genetic information, once those bits of those characteristics, once they're lost forever. They can never be got back. And that's why you see all sorts of different species under various, you know, larger classifications. Like dolphins and whales can actually interbreed. Lions and tigers can interbreed because they are the same genus kind. And they've lost information, but they're still the same kind. So they can interbreed, but animals go off in different directions. And as they lose information, they become different species. But they're not acquiring anything. Okay, and so I think that's one of the main things. The genetic entropy, one of the things they point out in the DVD, and Dr. Carter, who's an expert on that subject, just makes the case. It's the idea of genetic entropy, the fact that mutations and natural selection, differential reproduction among the various life forms, does not result in new information or new traits or new characteristics, but rather the loss of things. Sometimes the loss of certain information is advantageous to certain animals. For example, let's say that dogs have a short hair gene in them, but because the temperature is so cold where they are, only the ones that have long enough fur to keep them warm are the ones that live. And so they're the ones that reproduce, and then the long hair gene continues being passed on for hundreds of generations. That short hair gene, once it's lost and gone, it's gone for good. Now, you would say, okay, well, that's speciation. You have a kind of a new species. Yes, but it's under the dog kind, and it doesn't represent new information or new traits being given to that animal. It represents the loss of information that can never come back. Once it's gone forever. Okay, and so genetic entropy, Dr. Carter points out, it is absolutely fatal to the idea of evolution. Micromutational, very small changes, supposedly building up new traits. I mean, think about everything that would have to happen for a single-celled organism to eventually be a human being. All the different types of cells and everything that has to work together. One thing, you know, they talk about, Richard Dawkins just said, the first self-replicating molecule, or I've heard him say in another context, the first self-replicating protein. Okay. How do you ever gradually get to sex differentiation? That was one thing, even when I was a kid, when I was younger, when I was taught evolution, there were so many questions I had about the idea that a simple single-celled organism eventually became humans. I thought, you know, okay, well, some of these organisms, these are able to reproduce asexually. They don't have male and female counterparts. How do you slowly, gradually, through slow steps, get to male and female counterparts that copulate to reproduce? How do you slowly but surely get there? Well, I mean, I can understand, given the advances in our knowledge of these various fields of genetics and everything else, why Richard Dawkins might say, okay, all right, yeah, it's pretty complicated, and you can, I mean, even if the entire known universe was nothing but a soup of RNA molecules, you're still not going to get a paramecium, you're not going to get an amoeba out of that, it's too complicated. Okay, well, maybe E.T. did it. It's like any intelligent designers but God, and anyone but God. Okay, so genetics and DNA, the deoxyribonucleic acid molecule, DNA molecules that exist in every single cell in your body are absolutely filled with an almost unimaginable amount of information. And that's what Michael Behe, another book, I want to recommend another book, Michael Behe's book, Darwin's Black Box. If you've not read Darwin's Black Box, you need to read Darwin's Black Box. Now, Michael Behe is, as I recall, a microbiologist. Okay, so this guy has wrote the book Darwin's Black Box. What is a black box? Well, it's kind of like a computer. You know, the computer is a black box. It just does stuff. We know what it does, but we don't really know how it's doing it. Same thing with our smartphones. I mean, smartphones are big-time black boxes. We don't even know. I don't know how the technology works in these things. It's pretty remarkable. It's pretty amazing what they can do. But it's a black box. It just does something. We know what it does, but we don't know how it works. In Darwin's time, it was believed that cells, they knew they were there, but they didn't really understand what they were. They thought they were just little pieces of plasma or something like that. What we know today, thanks to electron microscopes and the progress of microbiology, individual cells, and your body is made up of trillions of them. Individual cells are so complicated that Behe coined the phrase irreducible complexity. And what he means by that is forget the human body. The human body is infinitely more complicated, but a single cell, an individual cell, is so complex that you cannot break it down into its individual component parts. It's impossible. It's too complicated. There are machines inside of machines. There are repair machines. There are enzymes that speed up processes, which if they weren't there, could not happen. There's the little rotary things, the motors, the conversion of what is it, adenosine triphosphate, the ATP rotor thing. It's almost 100% efficient, and your body reproduces that your own body weight and that stuff every day, and this is going on in every cell in your body. The exquisite repair systems to the DNA molecules as things divide and so on. It's absolutely unfathomable. If you've never seen a video of a walking kinesin, you need to see that. Okay, inside of cells, there's these little things that look like giant brains with legs coming out of them. They walk up and down DNA molecules with addressing systems and everything else. And Behe just says, okay, given what we know about Darwin's black box, the black box being the cell, cells are so ridiculously complicated that the idea of evolution, it just doesn't work for this. It's too complicated. Okay, if the entire universe is every conceivable chemical reaction known to man and everything not known to man, you're still not going to have the creation of life. You're not going to have the creation of a single-celled organism that can divide and copy its DNA into the nucleus, into the chromosomes and the DNA, the deoxyribonucleic acid, this ginormous long molecule. That's not going to happen. It's information. The information on how to build the cell and how to build all the stuff in the human body. It's crazy. Even Darwin said, you know, looking at the human eye and the way that the human eye works. How do you account for that with a slow process? You realize that your eyes are actually part of your brain. And as the miraculous, divine weaving together of a human baby in the womb, it's actually the little buds that come off of the brain and go into those eye sockets. How do you get there slowly but surely through mutations? By the way, most mutations are fatal. That's what they point out. Most mutations are not the acquisition of new characteristics, they're the breaking of existing stuff. And once in a while, you know, if something breaks and it is advantageous to an organism, but it's not going to evolve wings or feathers. You know, I remember learning that birds squirrels evolved from snakes. I thought, really? Cold-blooded becomes warm-blooded. Laying eggs that hatch becomes giving birth to live young that are nursed on milk, and scales fray out and become fur? How does that slowly but surely happen? It doesn't. It can't happen. The fact is, what the fossil record says, and they point this out in the section on the fossil record, the fossils do not show evolution. They show special creation, and they show animals already mature. One of the things they point out, there's a whole category of living things called living fossils. One of them is called a coelacanth. A coelacanth is a fish, and they have a very well-preserved fossil of a coelacanth. And they describe this fish, you know, lived 180 million years ago and went extinct, you know, ba-da-da-da-da, until someone in Japan caught one. And it looks just exactly like it. And you think, that's really 180 million or whatever years old. Doesn't it need to get with the program of evolving here or something? Okay. Fossils do not bear this out. The origin of life, that part is just laughable. And that's like what Dawkins says. Nobody knows. Nobody knows where it came from, unless it was, you know, perhaps it was E.T. from outer space that came and seeded life here on Earth. But that just raises the question, where did they come from and how did they get here? And, well, maybe they were seeded by someone else. Eventually, you're going to have to answer the question, how did something as complex as life come about by accident? Let me put it this way. People want to say, well, you know, DNA and cells and the human body and life, it just has the appearance of design. It just looks like it was designed, but it really wasn't. I want to just say, that is as absurd as walking up to the Mount Rushmore, where you have the faces of, who is it, Washington, Lincoln, Jefferson, and Roosevelt, carved into the side of the mountain there, and asking, I wonder what caused that? And someone going, what do you mean, what caused it? Who carved those faces in there? Why do we know that a mind did that? Because there's information there in the rocks. Rain and wind are not. I don't care how, if everything in the universe is rain and wind, and everything around it is rocks, you're not going to get the faces of Washington, Lincoln, Jefferson, and Roosevelt. It's not going to happen. It'll never happen. So when people see things like that, They know that a mind is responsible for it, that intelligence did it. And yet people look at information that is infinitely more complex in a cell, in a DNA molecule, and think, oh, no, that wasn't created by anything that thinks. That wasn't created by a mind. That happened by accident. But they'll listen to, in the SETI project, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, there are people that listen to outer space constantly. And if something sounds like a burp from outer space, it's E.T.! You look at a DNA molecule, no intelligence there, no design there, and something burps in outer space. It must be intelligent life! You think bias has a little bit to do with what people see and report and what they don't see and don't report? Absolutely. You bet it does. Bias is everything. Bias is everything. Okay, the book goes into the fossil record. The fossils, one of the things that's pointed out in the DVD and also in the book and gone into in some detail is that fossils, number one, fossils are extremely rare. They are extremely rare in nature. Fossils normally are not formed. When animals die in the wild, what happens to them? They are completely and totally consumed. They are completely and totally consumed by microbes and by scavengers. Scavengers come and pick them apart. I mean, you see them. There was a, you know, I live with a cow pasture behind my house. There's, you know, probably 400 acres. And, you know, we've seen a lot of cows give birth, and it was a sad thing. A cow gave birth to a stillborn calf, and I mean, every kind of vile scavenger bird was over there picking at that thing. And also, just the microbes and the rotting, it just stunk up the whole neighborhood. But, you know, the farmer threw some stuff on it to like, speed up the decay, and it's like, boom, it's gone. It's gone. He didn't have to go get it and, like, carry it away. Nature did its thing and destroyed it. And that's what happens to almost everything, every living thing when it dies. Almost everything is destroyed and is not fossilized. So what? How do fossils form? Fossils are proof not of something that happened slowly, but of something that happened very fast. Something has to be buried very quickly for a fossil to form. Because if it's not buried very, very quickly and by lots of mud and material to protect it, from nature around it, it is consumed. Everything in it will be consumed. It's bones, it's soft tissue, all of it. So fossils are very, very rare, and yet the world has lots of fossils, and they exist in these giant beds, and there are places, in fact, there's a place real close to where we live here, the Gray Fossil Site, where they were digging through and blasting away to build a highway, and they found this gigantic fossil bed. And they know what caused this. These animals, lots of them, smashed together by water. Okay, and so we would maintain that the majority, not all, but the majority of the Earth's fossils were formed during the flood of Noah. A lot of animals, animals that are extinct now, were buried in mud and all sorts of material like that very, very quickly, and that's why there are so many fossils. There are fossilized marine life all over the place. So you need to train yourself to know that. Okay, fossils do not normally form in nature. They are proof of something that happened extremely fast. Because almost nothing becomes a fossil. Almost nothing is fossilized. I mean, when fish die in ponds and local, in the river, I mean, they're consumed. They float and they're picked apart by birds and microbes get them. And the entirety of the fish is consumed by scavengers. It's actually a very gracious thing that God has done. If we didn't have scavengers, if you didn't have, you know, animals that ran around looking for dead things to eat, whose bodies and mouths and stomachs were designed to be able to process rotting flesh and everything, most of the world would probably smell really bad. And yet you see it. Every time you see birds flying around, there's a whole bunch of them flying around, you know there's something dead over there, and they're going to go eat it. And it's a gracious thing that God has given us those scavengers. I'm thankful for that. Okay, so fossils are very rare, but there's also the issue of when you see the various types of animals in the fossil record, at least the ones that aren't extinct, and most species and most types of animals are extinct. There's not very many left after the flood of Noah and the the way that the earth was changed by that made life a lot harder, apparently. We don't live as long as we used to. We're not as big and robust and strong. And I would also argue we are nowhere near as smart as the ancients. People talk about, you know, back when people used to be primitive and superstitious and dumb, C.S. Lewis called that chronological snobbery. I hate to break it to you, but we are the dumbest and most gullible generation in the history of time. And I'm gonna offend some other people too. The only reason I'm convinced that evolution is as widely believed today as it is because of genetic entropy, because human beings are dumb. We are not as smart as we used to be. The piling on of genetic mistakes, we don't think as clearly as we used to, and we are more stupid than people were in the past. People in the past were smarter than we are. But we have the piling on of all these genetic mistakes, and so we'll say, hey, somehow dirt became life. And through the piling on of mutations and genetics, there are male and female versions of humans that copulate and have babies with umbilical cords, and a single cell has all the information to divide into all the different layers of skin and bone and tissue and veins and arteries and muscles and organs and everything else. You ask too much of me to believe in such mythology. That's crazy to believe that. That did not happen. That's not how we got here. Okay, the fossil record doesn't work. Piltdown man is a lie. The vast majority of what passes for supposed links between ape-like hominids and humans were lies. The fact is, if it happens slowly and gradually, there ought to be a plethora of fossils where you could look and see things becoming other types of animals. And that's just exactly what you don't see. When you do see the different animals that are still around today, it's already that animal. Even the ones, you know, supposedly millions and billions of years old, it's already the mature form of the animal, which is exactly what we would expect to see to confirm the Genesis account. God made animals according to their kind. They don't cross over those kinds. One kind never becomes another kind. It only reproduces according to its kind. And that's exactly what the fossil record spells out. Now, I was told by some atheists recently that Stephen Jay Gould was stupid and that he's not a real paleontologist. Okay, he was a real paleontologist, and he was one of the most important paleontologists in modern history. And now, why would they say that? Why would they throw good old Stephen Jay Gould under the bus? Well, because of his theory of punctuated equilibrium. His theory that evolution took place so quickly that it didn't leave behind any evidence. So the lack of fossil evidence is proof of punctuated equilibrium. But that's just assuming your theory based on a lack of data, and then coming up with a rescuing device to prop up a theory that already doesn't have any evidence for it. So, the fossil record's lack of evidence that anything turned into something else slowly is widely acknowledged by all. Okay, the geologic record. One of the things that the professor, the PhD guy, Taz Walker, points out in that section of the DVD and of the book is that most geologists today are beginning to recognize that what they believe about uniformitarianism, that the key to understanding all the geological formations of the earth are present-day processes and how fast they are. He points out that's really, people are starting to move away from that, and they're beginning to see and recognize that most of the work in geology is done by catastrophes. Most of the work, most of the big formations of the world are not done slowly. They're done by catastrophes, by large disasters. And I think that's very, very interesting. Another thing that he pointed out, I was not aware of this until I read the book and also watched the DVD. Seismologists are able to take readings all the way down to the core of the Earth, and there are gigantic slabs of cool Earth crust way down in there. And they're wondering how those got there. Because they believe that the speed with which the continents are drifting apart, it's like two inches a year, that's what it's always been. Now, believing in catastrophism as we do, as God was a witness, he was there for the flood of Noah, and he told us that it happened. That was continental sprint, not continental drift. And you would have had subduction. You would have had a lot of that going on and large chunks of the Earth's crust going down very, very quickly into the molten mantle. And they're still cool down there. And what these seismologists are saying is if this has happened only 2 inches a year from the beginning, there would not be giant slabs of the Earth's crust that are still cold in the middle of the Earth. And yet, as a Christian, I know how those got there. It was the flood of Noah, when God opened up the fountains of the deep and ripped the Earth apart. And there was continental sprint. I mean, it was a big deal. That's how the mountain ranges that are so ridiculously high today were formed. Okay, the entire topography of the Earth was changed by the flood of Noah. And then they go into radiometric dating and they point out how that doesn't work either to prove that that anything is billions or millions of years old, because there were rocks tested from Mount St. Helens, which erupted in 1980, and those rocks were found, which they knew were about, 20, 30 years old, were shown to be like millions or billions of years old. So radiometric dating assumes what it's supposed to prove. It assumes uniformitarianism. It assumes that there's never been a global catastrophe that could ever have reset any of the atomic clocks on anything. And so it's just begging the question. It's circular reasoning. Cosmology, that section of the book and of the DVD is very weird. Because nobody has a clue how the universe got. If you don't believe that there's a God, if you're a philosophical naturalist materialist, how do you explain that why there's anything that exists? Where'd it come from? Why is it here? There are no good answers in that. And that some of the things that are proposed there are pretty bizarre. And then the last one on ethics and morality. Now, the atheists always get upset when we point out that the communist regimes and the political murders that took place in the 20th century based on atheism being applied to politics and being applied in Nazi Germany to the social structures of the world, and they destroyed the Romani people, the Gypsy population, the Jewish people, of course, they detested the Jews. And from their perspective, however, why not? You see, I'm a Christian. I have a basis upon which to say that is objectively truly evil. I don't care what societies or supreme courts say. It is evil for them to do that, to gas people to death, and to murder children in the Einsatzgruppen that followed the Wehrmacht into the territories of Western Russia, and the wholesale murder of Jews and Gypsies and anyone else that didn't like the looks of, and the pogroms that were encouraged by the architects of the Holocaust. You can fuss and say, well, it doesn't logically follow that we should do that. The problem is, okay, it doesn't follow necessarily that if you're a Darwinist, you're going to believe in such things. But how could you ever argue against it, would be my question. People say, well, the Crusades, and Christians have killed lots of people over the years. Yep, and they did so in direct violation of the teachings of Scripture. They did so in utter inconsistency with the Word of God. What Stalin, Hitler, Pol Pot, and Mao did is perfectly consistent with their presuppositions and their worldview of how we got here. Point being, there is no objective grounds for ethical absolutes or moral judgments about anything if there is no God and all that exists is matter in motion. All you have is might makes right. Now, immediately people want to object. Oh, that's wrong. That's terrible. How dare you say that? Well, I have an objective standard by which to say that. I have God's word and I have God's divine revelation. I have what he has said based on his unchanging character. What do you have? You have your opinion. And what about the way that the Nazis defended themselves at the Nuremberg trials? Who are you people to come in here and tell us how to run our country? Who are you to come in here and enforce your morality upon us? Well, everyone knows there's a law greater than our laws. There's a law greater than our laws. And just as there is a law that's greater than our laws, it doesn't really matter that most of the population of this country thinks it's a woman's right to murder their unborn children. It's still murder. And it's still evil. And God will avenge every single drop of innocent blood ever spilled. From Abel all the way down to the 70 plus million babies murdered in this country and everywhere else on this earth. Because that's always wrong. That's always wrong. Whew, okay. So, plug for the book, Evolution's Achilles Heels. Creation Ministries International put this out. It's outstanding. It's a little bit technical in places, but it's worth struggling through it to get the gist of the stuff that's in it. But just going over those hard sciences and those eight chapters, and they were things that were really largely unknown in Darwin's time. And the point is, as the hard sciences have developed, they have not supported, and in fact have refuted soundly, repeatedly, emphatically, the claims of Darwinian evolution. Well, oh goodness. Thank you all for watching or for listening. I need to get back to work. I've got a lot of stuff to get done for Sunday, but thank you all for being here and for listening or for watching. This is Pastor Patrick Hines of Bridwell Heights Presbyterian Church, and you've been listening to the Pulpit Supplemental Podcast. You can find us on the web at www.bridwellheightspca.org. Our sermons are streamed through Sermon Audio, and you can listen to that on the iTunes podcast version of Bridwell Heights Presbyterian Church. Feel free to join us any Sunday morning for worship at 11 a.m. sharp at 108 Bridwell Heights Road in Kingsport, Tennessee. And may the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious unto you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace.